If you did not grow up in a tradition that knew what the church calendar was, it's this rhythm throughout the year that the church observes, thinks about. And not all churches do it. Obviously, I didn't grow up in a tradition that did it, so obviously not all churches do it. But a lot of churches through time have observed a rhythm through the year that follows the pattern of Jesus' life, right? Year after year after year, looking at his birth and then his life and his death and all that it means. And so it follows that rhythm. So even though kind of the world has moved on, it's actually still Christmas on the church calendar, which I like. It's time for me to stop and spend a little more time thinking about what it means, this birth of this one into the world. And so we're going to look this morning at John 1. If you have Bibles, flip to John chapter 1. It's the fourth gospel. John's this guy that wrote down what he saw and heard from Jesus. He traveled with him. And John doesn't tell us the story of Jesus' birth in the same way that like Matthew and Luke do. Matthew and Luke talk about the birth and all of this. I think that John even assumes a little bit that you know that when you read this. That you're aware of what happened. John doesn't focus on what happened. He focuses on what happened means. Right? Like the thing that happened, I want to explain to you what it means. John kind of does that thing where he kind of tells you a big thing at the front and then kind of leads you to it for the rest of the work. And so he opens with what's called the prologue, the first 18 verses. Some people think it's a poem because it's so just dense, or an early hymn, a thing that people, it's just so marvelous. It seems so well crafted that people think it's just so much. And so if somebody asked me where to start reading the Bible, if someone said, I've never read the Bible before, where should I start? I would probably tell them, and usually do tell them, John. Like, start in John. It tells you who this Jesus is in a marvelous way. And there's other, depending on who you are, I might change that. But for the most part, if someone just said, man, I want to start reading the Bible, I don't know anything about it, where should I begin? I would say John. And I love this passage, the first 18 verses of this prologue. I love it so much. As a matter of fact, if you were in here before the service ever and we're doing sound check, this is what I quote. Like, we're checking the mic and I say, in the beginning was the word. That's from here. And then I jump down to verse 14. And then I jump to a sermon that I wish I could preach, but I never can, by this preacher that I know is just big guy. And he's like, there is no balm in Gilead. And one day, that's going to sound good, but not yet. So I love this passage so much, mainly because it perplexes me. I heard somebody say it this way. I think this is a really good way to explain it, is that it's shallow enough for a child to play in, but deep enough for an elephant to swim in. Like, it's both here. It's just so simple, but so deep as well. It's just a masterful piece of literature telling us an incredible thing. And we would benefit. We benefit from multiple readings. When we come back to this passage over and over and over again, we're just going to see more and more out of it. So different texts in the Bible, you don't read everything the same way, right? You don't read Psalms, deeply poetic literature, the same way you read Kings, right? And Kings is like a history of what happened. And so they're both truth, but we read them in different ways. And similarly, I try to preach them in different ways, right? It affects how I try to tell you what's going on, the text. So this text dictates that it be preached in a certain way, and I don't know what that is. I got no idea. So here's what's going to happen. Since I don't know how to preach this, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to start a timer, and I'm going to start talking about this text. We're just going to go through it. And when the timer goes off, I'm going to wrap up. And we're just going to end. That's how it's going to go today. So I'm going to start a timer, and we're just going to go at it, because I just don't know what else to do. All right. What I want for you, if you're not a believer, if you don't know Jesus, what I want for you to get out of this text today is an appreciation for who Jesus is, who he said he was and what he did, and how beautiful he is. If you're a believer, what I want for you to get out of this is the same thing, but also an appreciation that God has revealed himself to us this way in a book. I want you to taste and experience and see the beauty of his word and this Jesus that we talk about. That's what I want. I want you to be captivated today. So let's just read it, and then we're going to deal with it. Verse 1, in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him. Without Him was not anything made that was made. In Him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent from God. His name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came to bear witness about the light. The true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world did not know him. He came to his own, and his own people did not receive him. But to all who did receive him, who believed in his name, who gave the right, he gave the right to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness about him and cried out, "This is he of whom I said, 'He who comes after me ranks before me,' because he was before me. And from his fullness we have all received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He has made him known." Okay, so let's start here. Because in the first six words, there's about 1,700 things going on. So let's just start there. It says this, it starts this way. In the beginning was the Word. So if in the beginning, this is how Genesis starts. This is how the whole Bible starts. In the beginning. As a matter of fact, Genesis means in the beginning. So the whole Bible starts that way. Not only in the first five verses, there are a bunch of creation language, right? Life, light, darkness, making of things. There's a bunch of this creation language just in the first five verses. The problem is this, that the word that John uses, it's different than the word that's used in Genesis because it's two different languages. The Old Testament's mostly in Hebrew, and this is mostly in Greek. So the word that John uses here, it could mean two different things. It could mean in the beginning, like in a sense of time. At the very beginning, before everything else happened, this thing I'm about to tell you happened. It could also mean at the root of the universe. It could mean like the source of everything, the beginning of everything in the sense of the wellhead, the fountainhead. It is the very beginning of all that exists, the core and the root of the universe. He could also mean that. John does this a lot, though. Like in chapter 3, he's going to say that you need to be born again. Or it could say you need to be born from above. Both translations are possible. As a matter of fact, John does this so much where he uses a word that could mean two things, it becomes pretty clear pretty fast. He's doing it on purpose. This dude is doing it on purpose. Not to confuse us or to be vague, but to add additional meaning. Here's what I think he means. He means both. Whatever he's about to tell us about the thing in the beginning, not only did it happen before everything, the very first thing ever, before time, outside of time, the pre-existent time, not only that, it's also the core and the root of the entire universe. Whatever he's about to say, that's what he's talking about. So, in the beginning was the Word. All right, let's stop right there. This Word was with God, and the Word was God. So, the Word. If you were Hebrew, if you grew up Jewish, and you read this, in the beginning was the Word, you would think again about Genesis and creation. Because your God, the one true God, is a God who speaks. Not only does he speaks in powerful ways. He says a thing and it happens. God says in the beginning, you know, sorry, so the Bible says in the beginning, God spoke and he said, let there be light, and there was light. That's how God created. He said it. Not only that, he's a God who speaks through his prophets to his people. He's a God who says things. So if you read this and John wrote, in the beginning was the Word, you would think, oh, well, God says things. He's a God that speaks things out loud. He tells us about what he is like. He's speaking about this God, and his words are powerful. If, however, you were Greek and you read this, you would think something different. You would recognize this as a, even if you weren't like trained, you would recognize this as a philosophical word, right? The Greeks tended to think, and obviously there's a lot of Greek thought and a lot of argument and discussion, but generally when the word here, the word, you would know that someone was referring to the logic and rationality behind the universe. They looked around and saw cause and effect. They looked around and saw that you plant a seed and it rains and it, something grows. That somehow there is a structure and an order. Math is the same here as it is everywhere. There's some kind of order and logic to the universe. It's not complete chaos. In some way, there's things that can be made sense of. And so they were thinking, hey man, if there's some kind of force behind everything, that at the root of the entire existence and universe is some kind of logic. And the best way to live our lives is to align ourselves with that rationality. So you would read this text and think it had to do with logic and rationality, the force behind it. So what's John saying? I think he's saying both. I think he's doing both. I think what he's saying is that here, in the beginning, at the root of all that there is this mysterious thing called the Word. And it is the full, complete revelation of God. This Word is what's God telling us what he's like. In the beginning was this Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. I believe in God for a lot of reasons. I believe that there's a God for very rational reasons, right? Like, it doesn't make sense to me that this just happened. I understand. I've worn a lab coat and put things in with pipettes into test tubes. I'm science. Like, I love science. I know how to use a GC, a gas chromatograph. I'm not anti-science, but also as I've studied and learned, it's. Man, there's an order, and I just don't, I can't explain how everything came to be by accident. And I know there's arguments against it. If you don't believe in God, I'm not trying to oversimplify what you believe. I have limited time. But I struggle understanding how there can be structure. But more than that, I struggle living without meaning. If there is no God, then all of my thoughts are mere accidents of chemistry, electricity, and biology. There's no meaning to anything that I do. And I don't know anybody that actually lives their life that way. So I believe in God for these rational, well-thought-out reasons, but also by faith. But all of the things that you look at and I see in the universe, they cannot tell me exactly and clearly what God is like. You can infer a lot about what God, if you believe there's a God, you can infer a lot about what that God is like by looking at the universe. It's ridiculously big. He must be powerful. Not only that, it is incredibly varied. He must be incredibly creative. We can infer a lot of things about the universe, but we don't really know that God. He can even tell us from his laws and his rules, right? We have God's laws and his rules that he gave to his people, and we can infer a lot about what he's like from that. But until God says, this is what I'm like, we really don't know, right? That's true of human beings, right? You need to not only see what they have to say, but you need to know them in a way. I was at dinner one evening, and it was a group of us, and I don't even remember who all was there, but it was a while back. I just remember this moment, and someone was late, and sitting to my right was somebody, and so to my right, and she received a text and said, oh no, they're mad, and I went, what? what do they text? Why are they mad? How do you? And they said, what did the text say? And she says, we're 5 minutes late. The text says we're 5 minutes late. That's all it says. Yeah. How do you know they're mad? Trust me, I know they're mad. And I said, that must be exhausting living that way, reading between the lines of everything. And she said, it is. Here's the thing. She was right. They showed up and they were mad. Here's the thing. She knew them and their words. And so she knew both things. And so that's what this text is saying, is that God has revealed to us what he is like ultimately, not just in his creation, not just in his laws, but in this mysterious word. Also, behind everything is a logic, a rationality that flows from him. So, this is huge, right? What John is saying, and this is philosophically in the world, is revolutionary. What he's saying is, at the center of the universe is not some force or some principle or some fate that we're locked into. It's not something that we cross our fingers and hope everything works out okay. What he's saying is that at the center of the universe, a thing that existed before all things has never changed. The very thing at the middle of our existence is a person. A person. And that's way, way better than a force. Because I can't ask a force for a thing. I can't ask a principle for a thing. I'm just governed by it. John says at the center of everything before everything existed was this person. This person that you can talk to, cry to. This person you can plead with, laugh with, thank. A personal being. We're not just crossing our fingers and hoping about our lives, but the core of our existence is a relational being. There is someone there, and this word is the final say on what he is like. So, if this is true, if there is this God and he's this way and he's made himself known in the word, and that word is the root of the entire universe, well, the only thing to do that makes logical sense is to base your entire life on him. Right? Like, if the entire universe functions this way, why wouldn't you build your life on that? What better foundation to build on than the personal, creative, wonderful word? Look, we make decisions every single day. Every single day, we make, I think the statistics say they study like 70 decisions a day. Some of them are dumb. They don't really matter. Mostly. Maybe they do. But the big decisions that we make a lot of big decisions every day, whether we realize it or not. And what is the governing principle that you use, that I use, to make these decisions? Like, there's something that guides you in all of those decisions. There's some rationale or feeling or emotion or desire that guides us in the decisions that we make every single day. Now, I'm not going to lie to you, because you're going to find out either way if you decide to follow Jesus. It does not always... Well, in some ways, it makes your life way better, like in all the ways that matter, like security and identity and purpose, but those are hard to get to, and you have to wrestle to hold on to them. But in some ways, it seems to make your life even like more difficult. So based on like our perspective from here, the Christian life is for sure counterintuitive. But it's so fulfilling. But if this center of the universe came to earth, and we're going to go on to find out, spoiler alert, this word is Jesus. But he's talking about Jesus. But if this word came and Jesus came and he made his life about you and me, kind of just makes sense to make our life about him, right? To use him, the center of the universe, the final word of what God is like, the one that we've made us and that to whom we will answer, to make that the center of our life, so that when we are making decisions, we don't do it based on our fears and our anxieties, our comfort, but we do it based on him. Sometimes those things will line up. Sometimes they won't. And so at the center of the universe is this word, this thing that sustains everything. And And if I'm going to live my life in line with that, this what God is like and what he said about us, it makes sense that I consider seriously what he has said before I live, before I do anything. And that's what this is saying. It also tells us something about the nature of God. So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. So, okay, that's confusing because he says that the Word is with God, so distinct from God. He also was God. This is one of the great mysteries this is the Trinity, right? So let's just blow through that real quick, right? It's one of the great mysteries of Christianity, that there's one God in three persons. And it comes from things like this, where John, who chooses his words very carefully, says that this Word was with God, was distinct from God, but also was God. But there's one God. And this is just one of the great mysteries of Christianity, that Jesus is God, the Father is God, the Spirit is God, but Jesus is not the Father or the Spirit, the Father is not Jesus or the Spirit, and the Spirit's not the Father of Jesus. I don't know. It's mysterious and wonderful and beautiful, and it's so helpful to know that there's this relationship of loving at the center of the universe, but this sermon is not about that, so we have to keep moving. Guys, we're through six words. This is not going good. We're going to keep moving, though. I got 10 minutes. It says this: in the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So the Word is responsible for life, and he sustains life. And this life, this light, it comes into the world, it's in existence, and it says the darkness has not overcome it, or the darkness has not understood it. If you have different translations, you're going to have different versions of that, because both are excellent translations. It shined in the darkness, and that word could be translated just as well both ways as he's not overcome it. The light's pierced it, and the dark has not defeated it, has not conquered it. Or it could mean hasn't understood it. How about this? If we substitute the word mastered, D.A. Carson is this guy who writes a bunch of, he's a nerd, he writes a bunch of really good books, both theology books, but he said the word master would fit well. He's come into light and it's not mastered it. Darkness has not mastered it. Mastered, you can master something by overcoming it, or you can master something by understanding it, right? I've mastered a subject, or I've mastered a skill. Both have the same notion. That's what it's saying here. It's like, so which is he saying? I think both. The darkness is, Jesus came and he wasn't understood. Also, he came and he was not defeated. John is doing it again. Also, though, like these last few verses in this first section, these first five verses, it's more creation language. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness. So the light shining in the darkness and the life, is he talking about creation, or is he talking about when Jesus comes? Is he talking about at the very beginning the light shined in the darkness, or is he talking about when Jesus comes, he is the light shining in the darkness of the world? I think both. Oh, John. Listen, so Augustine said this. Augustine, who's this a long time ago, 1700 years or maybe more. Augustine said this. He said that it was for thee that Jesus was wearied with his journey. We find Jesus to be strength, and we find Jesus to be weak. We find a strong and a weak Jesus. Strong, because in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. Wouldst thou see how this Son of God is strong? All things were made by him, and without him was nothing made. And without labor, too, they were made. Then, what can be stronger than he, by whom all things were made without labor? Wouldst thou know him weak? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The strength of Christ created thee. The weakness of Christ created thee anew. The strength of Christ caused that to be which was not. The weakness of Christ caused that what was should not perish. He fashioned us by his strength. He sought us by his weakness. Oh man, that's real good. It's both. He's talking about creation and the new creation. He was there in the beginning, and he created us, and we owe our existence to him, and we will answer for the lives that we've lived one day when he stands as judge. Also, he's going to go on and talk about how we have to become new creations, to make us anew, not through his strength and the power of his word, but through the weakness displayed on the cross. Strength and his weakness. John is doing both because he is a bad man. All right, next section. We're going to be fine. Next section says this. There was a man sent from John whose name was John. Not this John, different John. John the Baptist. Not this John that's writing this. So a man sent from John. He came to bear witness to... He came as a witness to bear a witness about the light that all might be believed through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light. So it seems that maybe some of the disciples of John, some of the followers of John, were claiming that John was actually the Messiah. Even though John was like, no. John was very clear. He's not the Messiah. I'm not the Messiah. Go follow Jesus is what he said. John the Baptist famously said, I must decrease so he can increase. But he's correcting this and saying, hey man, there's this guy that came. His name was John. He was a witness to bear witness. All he did was say, that is the light. I'm not the light. That is the light. This is good advice for us. It's especially good advice for me. I can't save you. All I can do is point you to the one who can. All I can do is tell you about the one who can save you. All I can tell you is about the light. We aren't the light. We're just the ones that bear witness to the light. So I think a lot about how we are bearing witness about this light. This life that we have, right? Why are we telling people about it? Interesting. Let's move on. So it says this. It says, he comes into the world, the true light, which enlightens everyone, was coming into the world. So this word, he hasn't told us that it's Jesus yet. This word comes into the world, and then all of a sudden he says this. He was in the world, and the world was made through him. So it's this personal, right? All of a sudden he said this word, this mysterious word, is a he. So it's a person that's come into the world. So this life is the light of men. It's shown in the darkness. So this darkness, I think it's two things, right? It's not knowing, right? I'm in the dark. My son says to me, hey, Dad, what are we doing tonight? I said, I don't know. I'm still in the dark on that. We'll have to ask your mother, right? Like, I don't know. Nobody's told me the things. So there's this not knowing, but also there's the darkness that is the suffering and the evil and the hurt and the brokenness of the world, right? And I think that what's happening here is both of those things, right? It's the hurting and the broken and the darkness of the world and also us not knowing what to do about that. Because we don't, do we? We don't know what to do about the darkness, right? We just keep electing one inadequate person after another, right? We'll just keep hoping that the next thing will fix it, the next piece of technology will fix it. We don't know what to do about the darkness. If you did know what to do about the darkness, you would have already done it. If you know what to do about the darkness and you haven't done it, shame on you. We are all waiting for you to do something about the darkness. Even in our personal lives though, right? Like the darkness, like the chaos, the things that are uncontrollable. If you knew what to do about all of your deep anxieties and your shame and your fear and your hurt and the loss, you would have already done something about it, right? So what this says is that the message of Christmas is that light comes from outside, and it has to because we don't know. We don't know. We'll do the same thing over and over again, right? We're the rats in the maze that just keep getting shocked over and over again trying to get a pellet. That's who we are as human beings. It's insane. I mean, there's suffering and there's brokenness in the world. Some of us are suffering and broken because we keep making the same bad decisions over and over again. And you know it's true. Not you people. Not you guys. The people who aren't here today. Those are the ones that are doing the same things over and over again. Not you wonderful people. But people come to me and, hey, everything's bad. I don't understand why. Why doesn't Jesus care? And I'm like, are you still making the same bad decision you've been making for 2 decades? Yes. I feel like that's kind of on you. But here's the good news, right? Here's the good news. The good news about this is that he became flesh. That he cared. Even though you've made the same bad decision for 10 years in a row, he still cares. There's a person that still cares about you and your constant bad decisions. And he wants to guide you. He wants to shed light on that. He wants to guide you, but it's just so counterintuitive. The message of Christmas is that the light that we need comes from outside of us. How many times are we going to keep trying the same way over and over and over again before we listen to the author of life? That's why we have all these stories, because it's so hard to understand how God works, always through weakness and brokenness. But it's such a comfort. He was rejected, and that's tragic. It says that he came to him, and his people didn't know him. His own people didn't let him in. But those that did receive him, everyone that receives him, they are given the right to become children of God. All you have to do is receive him. Receive him as the light that he is. Receive him as the king that he is. And he makes you children of God. God's protection, God's relationship, the inheritance that he has earned for us, all of these things. We're going to be okay. We have 4 minutes. I keep moving the needle. We'll be fine. So this is this. And the word became flesh and dwelt among us. Okay, so this is mind-blowing. This, if you were reading this for the first time, right? That this word that he's talked about that created everything, that was the light in the darkness, that it took on flesh. Actually, he's using this like strong, almost crude word. Flesh, he doesn't say like the word became a man or the word got himself a body. What he says is that he chooses this expression that is incredibly blunt, because flesh in the Bible is... it's vulnerable. It's soft, right? It's pierceable. It's can be broken, right? That's, the flesh is all of the vulnerabilities that we feel in ourselves. That's what it is. The vulnerabilities and the hurts. And so this says that Jesus took on all of that naked frailty and need. What a contrast from he was in the beginning with God and he was God. John lifts Jesus, shows us really high, but then he shows us how weak he became. Basically what John is saying with this line is that God became killable. That God became killable and he took up residence. The word is the same as it's used in the Old Testament. A similar word. They would have been translated the same from the Hebrew to the Greek. As when God kind of filled the tent, right? He told the Israelites to build a tent. They were going to travel around with them, a tabernacle, and God was going to dwell in some special way in their midst, right? And he was going to take up residence there in some special way, and his glory would be seen, right? Shekinah glory, God's power and his might and his presence is going to be there. And John is saying that that glory took residence up in the midst of his people once again in this new way, in this knowable way. And this is a big deal because we're made to dwell with God, right? It's a big deal that God is dwelling with humans again. Because, as a matter of fact, the whole Bible is really just between humans dwelling with God, right? In Genesis, it begins this way. God makes man and they dwell together. They walk in the cool of the day in the garden together. And in Revelation, it says that he's going to come again. And we don't even need a sun because God's dwelling place is going to be with man. Everything else in between those things is us trying to figure out what God has done about the fact that we aren't dwelling with him. Dwelling with God is everything being as it should be. All the hurts and all the pains and the comforts, all the fears gone because we are where we're supposed to be. So they've taken up residence again. We were made to dwell with him. And this is incredibly, incredibly comforting. And here's why. That God took on flesh. It's incredibly comforting in suffering, in loss, because we can know for sure that God cares. We can't say that he doesn't care. I can say that I don't know why we're suffering. I don't know why the world is full of pain. I don't know why what you may be going through right now is so terrible. I don't know the reason, but I can tell you this. It's not because God doesn't care. And the way that I know is because the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. He took on our suffering and our pain and our vulnerability to save us. We can't say he doesn't care. I don't necessarily know why, but we do know that it's not because he doesn't care, which means this, that in some way, and it's sometimes hard to find, it's almost always hard to find, sometimes we can't find the reason, but it means at least this: suffering has some meaning. That may not help you right now, but it's just, it's better than it having no meaning. And then knowing that he's going to make all things right. Not only that, it also shows us that he got involved. That God steps in and gets involved. I don't know, but I often try to stay out of situations that aren't going to, you know, there's no benefit in it for me. I just think, you know what, I'm just going to stay out of this. And that's not what God does, though. God sees a situation and a brokenness and a need in those that he loves, and he steps in and intervenes. He becomes involved in the very workings of time and space to save us. And this is a big deal, because then he tells us to go do that. To become involved in the life of the hurting and the needy by being vulnerable. Sometimes we don't want to get involved in a situation in people's lives because we know that it's going to be messy. We know that it's going to take up an extraordinary amount of our time. We know that it's going to be emotionally taxing to be involved in these people's lives. And the incarnation says, yeah, I know, I did that. You should too. That through our vulnerability, somehow God does amazing things. And so we continue the work of Jesus when we make ourselves vulnerable, when we give to the point of vulnerability, of ourselves, to other people, financially, all of these things. When we give, we are about that work now. Ultimately, though, it says this at the end. It says, we're going to, I'm seriously ending. It says this, it says that we have seen his glory. Glory is of the Son, from the Father, full of grace and truth. Verse 16, and from his fullness we have received grace upon grace. For the law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen the God, the only God, who is at the Father's side. He's made him known. We've seen God's glory is what John says. So not just and the amazing things that he did, right? So Jesus goes on, and John tells us about these miracles that he does, these great teachings that he does, and we see God's glory in those. But really, what we also see, John says, that what we really see God's glory is actually in the cross. When we really see God's significant and weight and how glorious and magnificent and how much he matters is when this God who created everything took on killable flesh and goes voluntarily to the cross so that you and I might have life, that is when we see God as most glorious. The great exchange. My sin placed on him and his righteousness placed on me. Counted towards me. This is God's great glory. This is the thing angels long to look into. The fact that God becomes killable for you and me. And so now this is the great grace, right? He gave us grace and the law. It's a good thing that we had the law. Don't have time. But it's also good that grace and truth, it's better that grace and truth come through Jesus. That his undeserved, we haven't done anything to earn it, undeserved favor and merit poured out on us just because of who he is. This is the God that we're called to give our lives to, who pours out his love and his favor on us over and over and over again. This is what we give our lives to. This is what he calls us to give ourselves to. There's grace, but also there's truth. God's very existence means that there's a truth, right? We can't believe whatever we want and do whatever we want and believe that God's grace covers us. The fact is that there's a truth and we have to wrestle with it. And God has revealed to us what it's like, what the truth is. It's this person. We live our lives. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much. Thank you so much that you have revealed yourself to us. You have not remained hidden, though you could have. You have not stayed hidden. You have told us what you were like. You have shared with us what you do, and you have told us what it means to know you. You've told us how to have eternal life, how to become known as children of God. You've given us this grace upon grace upon grace. So teach us, shape us, mold us, and make us more like our Savior Jesus. It's in his name we pray. Amen.